Yeah. Put it on the table over there. Okay, so in 1897, J.J. Thomson in Cambridge discovered the electron with a cathode ray tube. And that led to the theory of the plum pudding atom. Have you ever heard of that? What do you think of it? Good idea, bad idea? Bad idea. Everyone agrees? Okay, we'll see. May not be such a bad idea. Okay, but the question is, why do you have a plum pudding? Okay, so this book here, is the... Why is it not sure? Oh, I know. No, that's not it. We want this. Why am I not getting anything here? Did you see it? What are we doing wrong here? Pardon me?
Zoom out and zoom out, brightness.
Couldn't hear.
Zoom out.
Zoom. But the trouble is, Oh, I know what I need. I need to open the iris. There we go. That's pretty big. So we zoom. There we go out. Okay. This book is The Corpuscular Theory of Matter by J.J. Thomson, published in 1907. In fact, this is the one... these are lectures given at the Royal Institution. But anyhow, in this book he talks about this subject. And he had a model of electron configuration within the atom. He said, consider the problem as to how a certain number, 1, 2, 3, n corpuscles, that's what he called electrons at first, although he changed his mind later on. So 1, 2, 3, or 4, whatever number of electrons, would arrange themselves if placed in a sphere filled with positive electricity of uniform density. So placed in a sphere of uniform positive electrical density. Now, why would he do that? Why would he put the electrons inside a cloud of positive density? Why not have the way we think now with a nucleus? Why put them inside?
Because it makes more sense for charge to just be distributed.
But the electrons he didn't think were distributed, yeah.
The negative charge will only be stable on a positive charge, so he had to have a charge everywhere.
So whose theorem did he know about? Earnshaw's theorem. If you had separate points, they couldn't be stable. You couldn't have a structure. But if you put the negative ones inside the positive ones, then you could get a structure maybe that was stable. He said, this is why a sphere? He said it was distributed in a way most amenable to mathematical calculation. He didn't know what shape it was. It could have been a cube or a tetrahedron or whatever. But a sphere was easier for calculating. And he said, we can solve the special case where the corpuscles, that is the electrons, are confined to a plane. So if you do it in two dimensions, you can solve this mathematically. And in fact, you can make a model of it. An American physicist named Meyer had made this model where he took a dish filled with water with corks floating in it, and the corks had magnetized needles all parallel to one another so they would repel one another and float, right? So they were constrained to two dimensions. Okay? And then he put this solenoid magnet up above and turned it on to suck them to the middle. So they have a force toward the middle, but they repel one another. And then he'd toss a certain number in and see what patterns they formed. So here you can see, if you go to this website or look at the slide here, you can see what happens. If you put one, it goes to the middle. Two, it makes a line, big surprise. Three makes a triangle. That's a surprise too, right? That three makes a triangle. But it's an equilateral triangle. That's not surprising. Four makes a square, five makes a pentagon. But sometimes when you do this experiment, the five becomes a square with one inside. There are two different energies you can get. Okay? And then if you do one inside five, one inside six, one inside seven, and then 2 inside 7 when you have 9, or 2 inside 8, which can be arranged that way where the line of the 2 points to a gap, or sometimes it's arranged that way where the line points to other points. Or 3 inside 8, 3 inside 9, and there are two ways of doing the 3 inside 8 or 2 inside 9 sometimes. Okay, then 4 inside 9, 4 inside 10, 5 inside 10, 1 inside 5 inside 10, right? 1 inside 5 inside 11. What's this reminding you of? Yeah. Like the shell structure of atoms. This wasn't lost on him, right? They knew the periodicity already, right? 1 inside 6 inside 11 and so on. Now, he said the equilibrium of 8 corpuscles at the corners of a cube. So if you go into 3 dimensions and try to take this sphere of positive density and put 8 electrons at the corners of a cube, that's not stable. He could show that mathematically. So much for Lewis's octet, right? Cubic octet. But Lewis said much later in 1923, I have ever since, his first hypothesis of the cubic octet that we talked about, ever since regarded the cubic octet as representing essentially the arrangements of electrons in the atom. So where does Lewis come off with this? Was he ignorant of Earnshaw's theorem? Right? You know you can't have that structure with Earnshaw's theorem. He said in 1916, the electrical forces between particles, which are very close together, do not obey the simple law of inverse squares, which holds at greater distances. That is, he thought Coulomb's law breaks down. So if you don't have inverse square, then you don't have Earnshaw's theorem, and you don't have to worry about that. Okay? And he wasn't alone. J.J. Thompson, the discoverer of the electron, Nobel laureate, 1923, wrote in the subsequent book, The Electron in Chemistry, if electron nuclear attraction were to vary strictly as the inverse square of the distance, we know by Earnshaw's theorem that no stable configuration in which the electrons are at rest or oscillating about positions of equilibrium is possible. I shall assume that the law of force between a positive charge and an electron is expressed by this equation. Right? Now, what is that equation? What's the first part of that equation? That's Coulomb's law, right? The one part. But there's a correction, a negative correction, which has to do with the distance and also with a constant that you put in, which is a length, so that when you divide it by a distance, you get a number. Right? So it's a length that's about the size of atoms. So once R gets to be smaller than C, then that fraction is greater than 1. Okay, when the electron gets to the size of an atom from a nucleus. Right? Because this is after the nucleus had been discovered and they knew it wasn't a big cloud. Okay? So once it gets in there, then that constant in the brackets or that function in the brackets becomes negative. So you change the sign of the force that's attractive, but then if it gets really close, it becomes repulsive, and then you can get a structure. Right? So Thompson said that. James Jeans, another great physicist, said this in 1923. So then a number of electrons can be in equilibrium about a positive charge without necessarily describing orbits around it. Okay, so this was 1923. Do you know what happened in 1926, 3 years later? It's really important for us. That's when quantum mechanics was discovered. So just 3 years later, they found out that Coulomb's law is just fine. It holds down to much, much smaller distances in the atom, smaller than the nucleus, smaller than almost anything. Coulomb's law is great. What was wrong with their mechanics was kinetic energy. And that's what quantum mechanics changed, and we'll talk about that later on, is how it reformulated kinetic energy to explain why electrons should be clouds with nuclei inside them in atoms or molecules. So it's a plum pudding, but it's backwards with respect to the charges. Okay, so cubic octets and ad hoc electrostatic force laws soon disappeared from conventional chemistry and physics, but shared pairs and lone pairs, which Lewis contributed, remained useful tools for discussing structure and bonding. Okay, so Earnshaw says there's no structure of minimum energy if you have point charges. They just will collapse together. Okay? That is no classical one. When you do quantum mechanics and treat kinetic energy properly, then you can do it, as we'll see. But despite Earnshaw, might there still be shared pair bonds? Might Lewis be right? Whatever Earnshaw says, might there actually be electrons between the nuclei holding them together? And might there be lone pairs? Well, how can you find out whether they're actually there? You have to do some experiment, right? How do you know? By seeing, maybe, if you can see them, or if you can feel them. Okay, we have to devise an experiment. Now, does that sound like an easy task? Why not? There's a problem. Right? They're inconceivably small for seeing purposes of seeing or feeling. Or are they inconceivably small? Just how small are atoms? Well, the people who wrote this book, which I think you can still buy, I bought it about 10 years ago, is called Occult Chemistry. It's still in print. It was first published in 1909. It was actually published in a journal before that of Theosophy. And then the book was published in 1909, again in 1919, and this edition is 1951. Right, so use clairvoyance to see this. Okay, that was their idea. Annie Besant's a really interesting person. Well, so these are the guys that collaborated in this. The Bishop Charles Webster Leadbeater, who was a bishop of his own church. He was the lead bishop. There were about 100 subsidiary bishops and about 300 people altogether in the religion. And he was the first one to see atoms, and Annie Besant learned the trick from him. She's really interesting. Has anybody ever heard of her? Shankar, my contact over in physics that teaches the physics course, is a really smart guy. He went to the Annie Besant school in Madras in India. She's very famous in India. And Kurum Pumalaji Jinarajadasa, who was their secretary and collaborator. But anyhow, what did they do? Well, they went into a trance and they said they could see these atoms. They took samples of different elements and they looked at them and saw what you could see down in there. And then there are different phases, they called them, or levels. You start with the solid, you know that, then a liquid, then a gas. But then you can go even more refined and see wheels inside wheels inside wheels inside wheels. So for example, if you look at the hydrogen atom, which looks like that as a gas, if you look at these little things, they look like E4. And then if you look at inside those, the little dots, they look like E3, and inside those are E2. And inside those are those E1 things up at the top. Right? Or this one here is oxygen, which has spirals inside, or helices. Right, but they go up to the same thing. They only draw one of these in detail because everything is made out of the same stuff, and this is the fundamental unit they saw of matter, and they called it Anu, which comes from Sanskrit. Right, and this was 1895. Last summer, I visited a garden in Scotland called the Garden of Cosmic Speculation. Created by an architect, Charles Jenks, to express the universal truths of science. And he has a model of an atom there. And, I was going to say, the proof of the pudding is that in hydrogen there were 18 Anu, in oxygen 290, in nitrogen 261. And if you divide by 18, you get the atomic weights. Right? You were doubting, weren't you? Okay, but this is the model of the atom in Jenks's Garden of Cosmic Speculation, and I see a certain resonance there, don't you? Yes, Brian?
How do they calculate how many atoms were in each?
Well, they could see them by clairvoyance. And their helper, Jinarajadasa, they would see it and he would write it down how many they saw. And then at the end of the day, they'd look at how many, and by God, if you divided by 18, it was the atomic weight. Yeah. We'll talk about that later. Okay. Incidentally, he said he constructed this sculpture with the help of several scientists. Okay, so these are some pictures of occult atoms. You'll want to know what they look like. There's helium. It had 72 Anu in it. And there's lithium with 127. And there's iron with 1008. And there's neon with 360 Anu. Now I see you smiling. But if I showed you that and said that was the 4F orbital, the electron density in the 4F orbital, would you laugh? So why should you believe this and not believe, why should you not laugh at this? Yeah? Yeah, because I said so, right? Whereas Annie Besant said the other thing. No, we don't go for authority. We have to find out where this comes from before we believe it. Okay. So here are some bases for scientific belief. One, there's evidence. Remember Faraday said you should always cross-examine the searches. So we're going to need evidence that that's right. And logic. And taste, that's the most interesting thing, but that you acquire slowly, it matures with experiments. So you've probably got enough taste already to realize that clairvoyance is nuts, right? Right? But you should wonder whether I'm nuts too until I present the evidence. Okay, there's sodium with 418 Anu. And they went beyond atoms. Look at this. Here's a model. It's actually a physical model. This is wood. That's not part of the substance, right? It's a wooden model. You've seen models of molecules and things. This is a model of sodium carbonate created by these theosophists. And so there are two sodiums you can see in there. What other atoms do you see? The spiral of oxygen, how many? Right. CO3, it agrees with the chemists, right? Okay, and the carbon is this other stuff that's threaded through through that far oxygen. And they wrote in their paper, note this triangular arrangement of O3 has just been deduced by Bragg from his X-ray analysis of calcite. So they're in agreement with the other chemists. Right? Of course, how you get three and not have them be a triangle is interesting. But at any rate, here's their model of an organic molecule, benzene. And of this, they said, each of the three valences of each carbon are satisfied by hydrogen. And the fourth valency from the carbon, which some have postulated is going to the interior of the molecule, does actually do so. They can see it by their clairvoyance. So remember what this problem is, that you have benzene, and the question is, what about that fourth red bond for each carbon? Does it flip back and forth in some mysterious way? Or do they all meet in the middle, as was proposed in 1889, and that's what they actually saw, the clairvoyant people. So they confirmed this as opposed to the other approach. Okay, now, there's not always a great gap between what's sensible and what's not sensible. If you look, you came in through this portal today, it said erected 1921. But actually, in 1923, it looked like that. They hadn't carved the erected 1921 yet, and all these plaques around the building hadn't been carved yet. They carved them later. So the question is, what are you going to carve on them? So they had a big meeting of the American Chemical Society here to dedicate the building, and a lot of famous people that we'll talk about. G.N. Lewis, for example, with his cigar was here. He smoked something like 8 cigars a day or something like that. But this guy who came from Bologna, Giuseppe Bruni, made a suggestion. They were going to carve on all these plaques, they were going to carve the names of famous American chemists. And there weren't very many good American chemists as of that date. And Bruni suggested that they put on dead chemists that had already, where people had had a chance to evaluate their contribution. And that's what they did. So we can be thankful to Giuseppe Bruni. But one of these plaques has, it's over on that part of the building, it says Van't Hoff. Have you heard of him? We'll talk a lot about him in the course. Gibbs, heard of him? Mendeleev, heard of him? Crookes, heard of him? You can't win them all. So this is Sir William Crookes. He was a fellow of the Royal Society. In fact, president of the Royal Society. He was a fellow of the Theosophical Society. In 1861, he discovered thallium. He developed the cathode ray tube, the thing that gave X-rays, which is shown here. He invented the Crookes radiometer. Have anybody ever seen a Crookes radiometer? It's to measure intensity of light. There's a picture of it. You ever see one? Right? Crookes invented that. Right? So he was president of the Royal Society, president of the British Association for Advancement of Science, and he was the president of the Society for Psychical Research. And he said to the British Association in 1898, telepathic research does not yet enlist the interest of the majority of my scientific brethren, but it was very interesting to him. And in fact, he's the guy who supplied the samples to Leadbeater and Besson so they could use their clairvoyance on it to try to figure out what they look like. And he's right out on front of our building. Okay, so the question is, are molecules unobservably small for our common eyes? Right? Remember, Newton said vulgar eyes. Are they inconceivably small? Well, they're very small, that's for sure. So a cubic centimeter of water is an 1/18 of a mole, right? Because it's a gram. And that means it has 6/18 times 10 to the 23rd molecules. That's a big number, right? So they must really, really be tiny. But if you think about the dimensions of a molecule, you're rarely interested in its volume. What are you more interested in? Its diameter. When you talk about the size of something, you're not talking about volume, you're talking about how wide it is. So why is that relevant here in talking about what an enormous number? How do you get from the volume, say it's a cube, to the length of the cube? Yeah? You take the cube root, right? And if we take the cube root of that, that means there are 3 × 10⁷ molecules per centimeter. Now that's still a big number, but it's nothing like 10 to the 23rd. Okay, so it's not so inconceivable as 10 to the 23rd is. So that means that a molecule is about 3 angstroms long. Okay, 0.3 nanometers long. So we come back to 10 to the 5th again. Remember where we saw it before? In terms of energies, remember electrostatic energy, strong force, so on, magnetic interaction. So here's 10 to the 5th in terms of distances. So the lecture room here is about 10 meters wide, right? And one of the hairs on my head is about 100 microns in diameter. So the ratio of those two is 10 to the 5th. So if you took 10 to the 5th of my hairs side by side and put them across the room, they'd fill it, right? So my hairs are very small compared to the room, but it's not inconceivably small. Okay? Okay, now a molecule is about a nanometer. A small atom is about an angstrom, about 1/10 of a nanometer. Okay, so a nanometer. But a nanometer to a hair is 10 to the 5th. So if you can imagine the room to my hair, it's the same to go from my hair to a molecule, a small molecule. Right? So that's small, it's very small, but it's not inconceivably small. Okay? If you go to a nucleus, it's 10 femtometers in diameter, right, which is another 10 to the 5th. So if you had if the atom was the diameter of the room, or a molecule, small molecule is the diameter of the room, a nucleus would be the size of a hair, the diameter of a hair. Okay, so these things are small, but they're not inconceivably small. Okay, now Newton in his optics said the thickness of the plate where it appears very black is 3/8 of the 10/100,000th part of an inch. He says is. Somehow he measured that distance. 3/8 of the 10/100,000th part of an inch. 10/100,000 is a million, right? So 3/8 of a millionth of an inch he somehow measured. How could Newton, so long ago, measure something so very small? That's the size of 30 water molecules, and Newton was able to measure it. And the way he did it was with this stuff here. Let me see if I do this. So here's a scale. Oops. And now I'll turn the light down a bit. And here are two pieces of glass. Which I'll put there. Okay, and now I'll zoom in on that. Okay, and cut down the light a little bit more. Okay, no, nothing special there. Although sometimes you can see a little something, but I don't see it. But watch what happens if I turn the piece on top over, if we're lucky, and it works the way it did last. There, see that? See that in the middle? Let's zoom in on that. Where is it now? It's right there. There. Isn't that interesting? That's what Newton saw. And in fact, Hooke had already interpreted this pretty close to correctly. But Newton gets the credit and the name for it. What do you call those things? Yeah. Pardon me? Newton's rings. They could be called Hooke's rings. Okay, why are they there? Well, when I put these two pieces of glass together flat to flat, you can see sometimes little like rainbows in there. Do you ever see that with microscope slides? Okay. But it turns out that one of these is a lens, convex. It's very slightly curved. So I turn it over so it's curved against flat. Then we see that little dot in the middle here. See it? Which you see over there as well. Okay, now it's about a millimeter gap out at the edge, but it gets thinner, and at the center, obviously, they touch. So you get Newton's rings, which are different colored depending on how far apart the gap of the glass is. Right? So, what Newton did, he measured the diameter of these rings. So you get different colors at different diameters. And then he can just do geometry to figure out there's a certain air gap there that corresponds to a certain color. He measures what the diameter is there, or the radius. He knows the curvature of the lens from how it focuses the light. And he just does trigonometry to figure out what that air gap is a certain distance from the center. Everybody see what we're talking about? Thus, this is just geometry. So then he knows that a given color is associated with a given distance. And this one that he's talking about, the air gap there, is 1.8 microns. But he says that's the sixth ring, right? The sixth ring already is there. If he does the geometry and goes into the middle, he can measure distances of 30 water molecules. Pretty neat, huh? Just by the color it gives. Okay, but there's simpler measures of even smaller distances. For example, done by this guy. You know who that is? Benjamin Franklin, yeah. Okay, so he published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. Philosophical, remember, means scientific. Okay, and the paper was on the stilling of waves by means of oil. What common saying goes with that? On the stilling of waves by means of oil. Pardon me? I couldn't hear you. No. Did you ever hear of making waters still by pouring oil? You hear? Yeah. No, what's the saying? Pour oil on troubled waters? Did you ever hear that saying? That's only in the old days, I guess, when I was growing up, the people used to say that. Okay, so here's what he wrote to William Brownrigg in 1773. I had, when a youth, read and smiled at Pliny's account of a practice among the seamen of his time. So Pliny was, you know, way back when. To still the waves in a storm by pouring oil into the sea, as well as the use made of oil by the divers. So divers would take a mouthful of oil and they'd go down, and if the ripples started on the surface and caused the water, hindered the light, they'd let oil out of their mouth and it would still the water and they could see better. That's what Pliny said. But Franklin, when a youth, had read and smiled at this, right? It seems sort of silly. I think that it has been of late too much the mode to slight the learning of the ancients. The learned, too, are apt to slight too much the knowledge of the vulgar, right? Those old wives might have known something. Okay? In 1757, being at sea in a fleet of 96 sail bound against Louisbourg, so off Cape Breton Island, I observed the wakes of two of the ships to be remarkably smooth, while all the others were ruffled by the wind, which blew fresh. Being puzzled with the differing appearance, I at last pointed it out to our captain and asked him the meaning of it. "The cooks," said he, "have, I suppose, just been emptying their greasy water through the scuppers, which has greased the side of those ships a little and stilled the waters." Right? Recollecting what I had formerly read in Pliny, I resolved to make some experiment of the effect of oil on water when I should have the opportunity. And he had the opportunity 5 years later when he was in London and was staying near Clapham Common, where there's a pond. Okay. At length, being at Clapham, where there's on the common a large pond, which I observed one day to be very rough with the wind, I fetched out a cruet of oil, and dropping a little of it on the water, I saw it spread itself with surprising swiftness upon the surface, but the effect of smoothing the waves was not produced. The experiment failed. So much for the old wives and Pliny, right? For I had applied it first on the leeward side of the pond, where the waves were greatest, and the wind drove my oil back upon the shore. So what did he do? He went to the other side, right? I then went to the windward side, where the waves began to form, and there the oil, though not more than a teaspoonful, produced an instant calm over a space several yards square, which spread amazingly and extended itself gradually till it reached the lee side, making all that quarter of the pond, perhaps half an acre, as smooth as a looking glass. So it worked. Right? Now, let's put some numbers to that. 5 cubic centimeters in a teaspoon. Half an acre is 2 × 10⁷ square centimeters. So you can reckon what the thickness of this layer was of oil on the water. And the thickness was 25 angstroms, the length of a molecule of oil. Isn't that neat? So he didn't know that he had measured it. But he had. He'd done the experiment that measured it. He said, "When put on water, it spreads instantly many feet round, becoming so thin as to produce the prismatic colors." That's these interference colors of Newton, right? "For a considerable space, and beyond them, so much thinner as to be invisible, except when its effect of smoothing the waves at much greater distance." So he had a neat trick for telling how far the oil went, right? How big the oil layer was. It was where the waves stopped, the ripples. Isn't that neat? It seemed, he said, he didn't say, "Therefore the thickness of the oil is 25 angstroms, the length of a molecule of oil." What he said, "It seems as if a mutual repulsion between the particles took place as soon as it touched the water." So they forced each other apart. The interesting thing about the slick is that the molecules are in contact, side to side, so you know how big the molecules are. He said they flew apart, so he didn't get the brass ring. Okay. So anyhow, there are ways of measuring really, really small things. Things of the size of atoms. Yeah. Henry? What? It's not easy to understand. I don't understand it. Okay. Okay, but our aim is to find out if there are ways of seeing really small things. Are there electron pairs? Well, one way is SPM, scanning probe microscopy, which allows you to feel, not see, but feel individual molecules, atoms. Does it allow you to feel bonds? That's what we'd like to see, whether these bonds are real. Okay, so it was invented by Binnick and Rohrer in 1981, so this is a very recent technique. I mean, 81 seems like ancient times to you, like the Civil War or something like that. To me, it doesn't seem very long ago. Okay, so they got the Nobel Prize for this in 1986, and it's really blossomed. There's so much new science has opened up because of scanning probe microscopy, one flavor of which is called atomic force microscopy. So on here, in here, there's a little gold chip. You'll see, I'll pass this around. It looks like this, except it's ever so much smaller, 1.4 millimeters. And on the bottom of it, there are these little triangles. See them? You can actually see the real thing in here. There's an image of what you're looking at drawn with yellow ink. But then if you tilt it just right so light glances off the surface, you might be able to see those little triangles. You notice they're not very big. Here they are blown up in a micrograph. There's the size of a hair compared to those things. The smallest scale division is 20 microns there, which is still enormously, of course, bigger than molecules or atoms, right? It's 10,000 times bigger. Okay, so in a given experiment, you just use one of those cantilevers. There are five of them there, so you can use whatever one you want. And that's what a cantilever looks like. It's a little triangular thing. And at the end, there's this little dimple, or actually, it's a little pyramid. Here, that's only 50 microns, that scale there. And if we look at that little bit, you can see there's a little pyramid there that comes down to a point that's smaller than a micron. And in fact, at the very tip, the radius of curvature is only 20 molecules. Right, and you can buy finer tips that come down to just a couple molecules, right? Just a nanometer or two. But anyhow, the typical ones are about 20 nanometers. So you put them on this piece of glass, and you mount the glass on the bottom of this thing, and a laser shines. So here's this little blown up, this little pyramid right on the end of a thin gold-coated thing. So you send a laser light down, and it bounces and comes up to this detector up there. And what happens if I were to push this tip up a little bit? What would happen? Yeah. Well, if you pushed it far enough, it'd go straight up, but I would deviate that thing. Right? So you can tell how far it goes up by how much that deviates. So up in that area, there's what's called a split diode, so that the light, there are two light detectors right next to one another. So the light comes in and hits them, but if it goes a little bit this way, you get more voltage on this one and this one. If it goes this way, you get more voltage on this one and this one. So you can see the light moving back and forth that way. Very sensitive. Okay? And in fact, it's so sensitive, that detector, that it's sensitive to a change in height of the tip of one molecule. Right? So now what you can do is scan it back and forth over a surface like an old-fashioned record player. Watch it go up and down and feel individual molecules. For example, here's a picture of a surface of a benzoin crystal. Now, laterally, you don't have very much resolution. That's 5 microns, right? So a 20th of a hair across here, about 600 molecules, and the same vertically, I mean up and down in the screen. But in and out of the screen, that's actually up and down in the machine, right? You have very exquisite resolution. So each ledge here is 1.7 nanometers high, 2 molecules. That's the unit cell that the crystal packs in, right? And that hole in the middle is deeper. It was caused by scratching with the needle to make it 5 nanometers deep, so 4 or 5 molecules deep. Okay? And now you can put it under water and propanol and watch the crystal dissolve. Individual molecular layers coming off just by feeling them the way you would do with a record, old-fashioned record player. Right? Isn't that interesting? So you can measure how fast the ledges move in different directions in the crystal. Right? So you can actually feel individual molecules. And you can do individual atoms. This was done in 1999 by George Flynn, a graduate of this department who teaches at Columbia. And here is a picture they did where the atoms appear in different colors. So that's a single molecule there, and here's a molecular model showing exactly what you're seeing. So you see individual CH2 groups and oxygens and so on. So you can actually feel individual molecules. Or you've probably seen this thing that was done in 1993 at IBM, where they wrote IBM with atoms and then made this circle of 50 some iron atoms on the surface of copper and so on. So you can manipulate and see individual atoms. Or there's that's called scanning tunneling microscopy, those last two. The first one was force. Tunneling we'll talk about later on. Okay. Or there's SNOM, scanning near-field optical microscopy. There's a problem with using really high-powered microscopes. You know what it is? That you can't see atoms with a normal microscope just by using a big lens? Yeah. What do you mean diffraction limit? It's the idea. We'll talk about that actually, because we're going to talk about X-rays where that's relevant. And what it involves is that if the wavelength of the light is much bigger than what you're looking at, you can't see any detail. Right? So normally you can't see really small things with light, but this scanning near field optical microscopy has a neat trick. Okay, so what you do is that thing poking down from the top is a glass fiber coated with aluminum, and it's drawn out to be very thin at the tip. So it's only 100 nanometers at the tip. Right, much shorter than the wavelength of light. So light comes down that glass fiber and comes out just at that tip. Even though its wavelength is long, its size is really small because it's coming through that tip. And then you have a sample underneath it. So the light comes down, hits the sample, and the sample might be something that fluoresces, that gives off light, red light when it's hit by the blue light. So then red light comes out and goes to a detector through a lens, so you know there was something fluorescent there. Now you can make a pattern of fluorescent molecules dilute on something else, right? So you scan this tip across it, and every time the light hits a molecule, you get red light coming out and you know it was there. See how that's working? Everybody see? So you move the tip, right? And every time the tip gets to where a molecule is, you know it because red light comes out. So you can go scan back and forth and figure out where the fluorescent molecules are. Brian?
How useful is that?
It's very useful. Here's a picture. Here's a picture that was made of a nano-fabricated material. And so this scale is of microns, and there's the wavelength of red light, but you're seeing features that are very much smaller than the wavelength of the light. Right. So at any rate, scanning probe microscopies, these different kind of atomic force microscope, the one that goes up and down and deflects the light, scanning tunneling microscope, where you measure the current that goes between a needle and the sample, and as it gets really close, the current goes up a lot, so you can tell where the needle is. Or SNOM, this thing we just talked about, they're really, really powerful and are transforming the study of nanomaterials. They can resolve individual molecules, even individual atoms, but they can't see bonds. That's too much. So all this is really powerful, but it's not going to get us there. Let's see. We have a few minutes left. The next topic you should read ahead on is about X-ray diffraction, about actually seeing electrons, because that's really going to allow us to see bonds, as you'll see. Okay, but in the meantime, I thought I would spend a few minutes talking about these problems that you're working on of drawing Lewis structures. Would that be helpful to you? Yes? Okay. So, here are some resonance structures for this HCNO isomers. And what I did was use the computer to do quantum mechanical calculations, where you calculate the energy for a given arrangement of atoms. Then you let the atoms move until they find the lowest possible valley nearby. Okay, they move downhill. Okay, so you find out what these structures actually should look like. Okay, so here is carbon in the middle, OCN with hydrogen on one end or hydrogen on the other. And the positions I've drawn the atoms in are their actual relative positions at the energy minimum as calculated by quantum mechanics. So that's the true minimum energy structure of these molecules. Now let's see how we do with Lewis structures. Okay, so we have carbon making four bonds, nitrogen making three bonds, oxygen making two bonds, hydrogen making one bond, unshared pairs on oxygen and on nitrogen. And over here we have it. So all these things do these things satisfy the octet rule? Good. All of them have octets. That's good. Okay. Now, can you imagine other structures that you could draw for them? Other Lewis structures. Well, you could take those electrons, put it there, and those out there. Right, that would give this structure, right? These electrons, we're drawing a curved arrow, remember, is in our pictures moving a pair of electrons. Not moving an atom, moving a pair of electrons. Right, so these electrons that were formerly only on oxygen are now shared between oxygen and carbon. That would give carbon too many electrons. So we take electrons away from carbon and put them on nitrogen. right? So now we have a positive charge here, but nitrogen is involved in the same number of pairs here as it is here, right? It's still, this pair that was shared is now not shared, so it's still an octet. So all these are octets, that's great. But now we got plus on oxygen, minus on nitrogen. So those would be resonance structures. Which one would be better, do you think? Which should it look more like? Sharif?
The top.
Why?
Because oxygen is very electronegative. If it would be unstable, it would have a type of polar.
Yeah, how could you say that in just a couple words? Yeah.
Well, I actually had a question.
Pardon me?
I had a question.
So. Okay, ask your question.
Oh, you said that you know those resonance structures. How can you talk about just one of those diagrams that it's resonance and not equilibrium?
Because these are drawn with the same position of the nuclei. Now, it could be that here the carbon would be a little closer to nitrogen and here it would be halfway between. And as far as you know, there could be two structures like that and it would be in equilibrium. Right, but if I mean that they're, remember I said I found them at the drawings I actually did were at the true structure, a true as far as quantum mechanics knows. You don't know that, but I knew that. Okay, so if these are two different drawings you can make for that same arrangement of the nuclei, okay. And you'd say that the top one's better than the bottom one, although you could draw two structures. And you wouldn't be surprised if it turned out that there was a little... This, say, predicts no charge on the atoms from a certain point of view. This would predict that it would be plus here and minus here. So maybe there'll be a little bit of plusness here and a little bit of minusness here in the true thing if the resonance is important. Does that make sense to you? I mean, it won't make perfect sense because it's such a crummy theory. It's not your fault, it's the theory's fault. Yeah.
You mentioned last time that resonance was just two peaks that created one minimum as opposed to equilibrium.
Not two peaks. What other words could you use? Not two valleys either. Two pictures. Two different ways of drawing lines and dots. Two different pictures of the same real thing. Right? So I'm using quantum mechanics to find out what the real structure is. And then I'm seeing what pictures Lewis might draw for that structure. And he could draw this structure or he could draw this structure. But you'd say it would be more like that than like that because you don't want to separate charges. Okay? So that has bad charge separation. And the most electronegative atom has a positive charge. That's not so reasonable. Still, it might be a little bit like that if you could draw that Lewis structure. Okay? Now over here you could move these electrons in here. They're still part of the nitrogen octet, right? Not for purposes of formal charge, but for purposes of counting the octet, right? They're still on nitrogen, but now they're on carbon, so you have to move away from carbon onto oxygen, so you get this. Now how about this structure as compared to that structure? Which one is better, top or bottom? Aviva, what do you say? The bottom? Is that what you said? Okay, why would you say so? I can't hear very well. Oxygen's really electronegative. So this would be a better situation than that one. Better to have minus than plus. Does that mean that this one's better than this one? Can't hear. This one has no charge separation at all. This is better than that. But if you're going to do it, it's better to, if you're going to separate charges, it's better to have it this way than that way. So you might guess then that for this structure, when the hydrogen is on nitrogen, it has more charge on the ends than this one does, maybe. Okay? But we're going to have to check things like that with experiments to see if it's true.
In this case, should you only draw the more stable, or should you draw...
You should try to draw the most stable, the most reasonable one, but you should be thinking it might have a little bit of this property. See what I mean? If you can draw another structure. Yeah. Say again? The ring structure. We'll get there. Okay, we're starting. So there's charge separation there, right? Now you could also do it that way, And then you have bad charge separation. So the bottom one is going to be more like it than the top, but the middle is probably the best of all. Yeah, Henry?
In reality, which one of the two, the middle or the bottom, is closer?
It's my guess that this is closer, but I don't really know the properties of the molecule, so I can't tell you. This is, remember, it's empirical. This is not a fundamental theory like quantum mechanics is going to turn out to be. Okay, or we can do this one with nitrogen in the middle. And let's see, we only have a minute here, so I'm just going to click through this really fast. Okay, so there's bad charge. There's better charge, and all of them have charge separation. You can't get out of it. Okay, and some of them have sestets. Some of them have, here's one that doesn't have charge separation, but two that do. And that's bad charge, and here's oxygen in the middle. And blah, 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 bad charge, sestet with bad charge. Here are the ring ones that you wanted me to get to. Now, this one, when I tried it with the computer, if I started with that structure, just an equilateral triangle hydrogen on the whatever on the oxygen, and let it go downhill, it opened up the ring. It wasn't a ring anymore. So there's no energy minimum like this. But there are energy minima that look like this and this with the hydrogen on those atoms, right? So that's bad charge there, blah, blah, sestet, blah, 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 blah. So here are all those things, right? And that is the structures calculated and the energies that were calculated for them. So this turns out to be the lowest of all the structures. This one's about 20 kilocalories per mole higher. This is about 70 kilocalories per mole higher, 80 for those and so on, and those are the highest ones of all. Now, I showed these structures to my colleagues in the chemistry department and asked them to rank them in terms of energy, and nobody could do it on terms of Lewis structure. You can do it by using quantum mechanics and calculate it and see what number comes out. But Lewis theory and resonance theory isn't that good. It's mostly used to rationalize what you've determined experimentally, that there's a little bit of positive charge here, a little bit of negative charge here. Aha, that's because that resonance structure is important. But that's not the same as a really, really great theory, I think you'll agree. Okay, so next time we're going to talk about how to use X-ray to see what bonds look like. And so it's good to read ahead. There's a web page about X-ray, and it's not easy, so you should read ahead on it.
Could you elaborate on the two slides before you said there was no energy minimum?
The way you do this, the way you do the quantum mechanics, is you put in a guessed structure you guess.
Okay.
It has a certain energy. And now you move an atom a little bit. Did the energy go up or down? It went up. So move it the other direction. Ah, it went down.
Right.
Now you move it in a different direction, see whether it goes up. Move another atom. So you keep wiggling around to try to make the energy go down, 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 down. If you're in a valley, on the side of a valley, you'll go down to the bottom of the valley, and that'll be the lowest energy structure. See how that works?
Yeah.
Okay, but what is that valley? If you start with that structure that I talked about, It opens it up. It's not a ring anymore. The others may make one bond a little longer, a little shorter, change this angle a little bit. But that one, there's nothing stable around there. It just opens up.
Oh, I got you.
Okay, good.
Also, if you have a lot of energy, could these be possible? If it's in a system with a lot of energy.
Yeah, they're all possible in principle.
Oh, okay.
But the question is, and in fact, you don't want a lot of energy. You want the molecule to have energy, but you don't want it to have any excess energy,
right,
so that it can move over a hill and go away.
I see.
You want it to be trapped. We'll talk more about that kind of thing at the end of this semester.
So you said that the theory was bad.
Your mic, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So you were drawing all these resonance structures for it.
Yeah.
Like, my question is resonant, does it basically have two different meanings? Like, is it just like possible Lewis structures is one meaning, and then like two different, if you draw a potential energy diagram and you have like one minimum,
yeah,
and the two resonance structures are right there, then that would be like, it would be like somewhere in between those two structures, whereas an equilibrium would have two different values?
That's right. It depends on the shape of this energy curve. If you have two minima, then they're two different molecules, and you can draw one picture for one and one picture for the other. But if in truth, the true stable molecule is between those two structures, then you can draw two different pictures for it. And it may be closer to one than the other. But resonance is a problem with our notation, with the pictures we draw. Not molecules know what they want to do. They don't do any of this stuff. Right? But if we're limiting ourselves to drawing lines and dots, things like that, then there could be two different reasonable ways of drawing that.
Right.
Right?
When you have two different ways of drawing the same molecule.
And sometimes, let me just continue. Sometimes those two would actually be different molecules, and you could get a bottle of one and a bottle of the other, at least at very low temperature. But sometimes that's not true. That the true structure is some composite. Your picture, it is some a hybrid of your pictures you're drawing, which is to say that the pictures you're drawing aren't very good.
Right.
You can't really draw that molecule. You have to say, it's a little like this, it's a little like this, it's a little like this. That's what resonance is.
Right. And equilibrium is when they're separate.
So it's when they're two different molecules.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you're drawing these different ones, you can't tell really if it's resonance or equilibrium.
Now, what I'm drawing is, as far as quantum mechanics was able to say, the real thing, the structure, the angles, the distances, and so on. That's the real molecule. And what I'm trying to show in this exercise is how many different Lewis structures I could draw for it. So, for example, if you have, if some of them have very bad properties, like charge separation or the wrong charge on the wrong atom, those are not going to contribute. Those don't help this energy, you'd say. No, those don't make it more stable.
Right, right.
But if you have two that are both pretty good structures, you might say, maybe the real thing is even better than either of those alone. Right? So you say there's, quote, resonance stabilization. But that's not something like Coulomb's law, which is something real. Saying there's resonance stabilization is just saying the thing is more stable than I would guess if I could only draw one structure. It's your drawing that's at fault, not the... Your drawing isn't a fundamental theory. Although most organic chemistry courses, I think, would focus on these resonance structures and so on as if it were something real. But really what it is that your notation isn't perfect.
Okay.
Okay?
Right.
Good.
So I think this is a corollary to this question in that assuming that there are two reasonable drawings, Lewis drawings of a picture, is there any, without going to experiments, is there any way to determine whether in fact those two exist in resonance or those two are separate?
No.
Okay, that was my question.
You have to do experiments to know the truth.
Okay.
Or do a calculation that is fundamentally right.
Okay.
Rather than using this theory.
No way to tell them apart without either doing experiments.
Well, you might think, you know, if you've been around this field for a long time and know which things do what, then you say you understand it. But really what you're doing is restating what you already know to be the fact as if you could derive it from theory. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And the trouble is that makes students think that they should be able to do it when they haven't been around and known the lore.
So it's like it's one of those lower order theories that doesn't predict or suggest.
Yeah. It makes some predictions.
Okay.
Right? But they're not subtle enough to deal with molecules like the ones we're talking about here.
I see.
Okay.
So yeah, like you call these all resonance, but there's no real way of telling whether it's like a mixture of all these species or whether they're separate.
Yeah. What I know empirically is that you don't have isomers, that is two different molecules, where the nuclei only have to move a tiny bit to go from one to the other. Like this one we're talking about, where is the carbon halfway between or is it a little closer to one to the other? In true molecules, the atoms are vibrating. So you can't have it trapped between two things that are very close geometrically to one another. But in fact, there are periodically people who come up with molecules where they say there are such isomers experimentally. And usually that turns out to be wrong. They call them sometimes bond shift isomers.
Okay.
But the fact is that you have to do an experiment to know.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's what, in time, you begin to internalize a lot of lore. And you begin, if you're using a theory like Lewis theory, you begin to think that it works, when in fact all you've done is fit it intuitively to what you know to be the facts, if you see what I mean. And that makes it tough for students who are trying, who don't know the facts yet.
I see.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure.